is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, December 10th, 2019. I'm Buster Olney, and producing back in Bristol is Troy Farkas. So in Game 6 of the World Series, Houston leading 3-2, Washington clinging to a 3-2 lead, bottom of the fifth inning, and Steven Strasburg was on the mound. This is what happened.
The 1-1. Fastball hit sharply, but what a stop by Turner. Out to the right of second base, and he fires on to first to get Brantley. An extremely hard hit ball, but Turner makes a really nice play, and the Astros leave a couple of men on. Wow, was that big.
It was big. Steven Strasburg was big. That call, by the way, from my friend Dan Shulman on ESPN Radio. And the next day, after Daniel Hudson struck out Michael Brantley to give the Nationals the world championship, I talked to Strasburg. Give a listen.
Steven, describe what you're feeling right now.
Oh, my God. Just amazing. Just amazing. You know, everybody counted us out. You know, we didn't quit. That's just not what we do. We kept fighting to the very end. You know, and we're world champions. World champions. It's unbelievable.
Describe the last 72 hours through your eyes of Max Scherzer.
Oh, my God. You know, just such a whirlwind. But, you know, we stuck together. We didn't give up hope. You know, we knew what we were coming into, and we were going to go out there and fight. That's what we did.
What was it like in the dugout when Howie hits his home run to give you guys a lead?
Yeah, we were talking about it earlier. And, you know, he got a text from one of his buddies, and he had us winning 3-2. So then it was 3-2. I was like, God, man, who's his buddy? But, no, man, that was huge. He's been huge for us all year, obviously in the postseason, and couldn't happen to a better guy.
What does this mean for you, someone who spent your whole career with this organization?
Oh, man, come a long way. You know, D.C.'s like home now, and, you know, to bring a championship back to there is just an unbelievable feeling.
Steven, congratulations.
Thank you.
He was fighting back tears as he said that. D.C. is like home now, and it will be for the rest of his professional life, presumably, after he agreed to a 7-year, $245 million deal. Reportedly, about a third of it is deferred with interest. The first really, really big deal of this offseason. Let's get to it.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Fire you, worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul Imbakides, a honcho on the show Get Up. He tells us he's the head honcho. We haven't been able to confirm that. He also is a huge baseball nerd. And Hembo, I really feel like that this might be the least surprising news of this offseason, Steven Strasburg re-signing with the Nationals, because as we just heard, he considered Washington, D.C. to be home, and Steven Strasburg is someone who does not like change. What was your reaction when you heard the news?
You've hit the nail on the head as it relates to Steven Strasburg from the very beginning of this conversation in expecting him to stay. Although I will say, I was surprised at the size of the contract. It is an extraordinary amount of money to pay someone with his injury history and of his age. If you even consider Steven Strasburg, since his Tommy John surgery, Buster, he's had 8 disabled list stints for 205 days on the disabled list. So this is not a player with clean medical records at all. And obviously the Nationals have much more data on it than we do. But that was sort of the first thought that I had. The second was, they're essentially choosing Steven Strasburg over Anthony Rendon. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems unfathomable that the Nationals would have enough money to retain both of them. And the ownership has essentially said as much. So it's not very often at all that you see a team's best position player by wins above replacement leave after winning the championship. It actually only happened twice previously in the last 80 years. In 2011, Albert Pujols won a World Series with the Cardinals and left. In 2003, Pudge won one with the Marlins and left. That's the only context we have at all for something like this happening. So, look, this is a team built around the starting pitching. But those are my first couple takeaways. Wow, that's a lot of money. And say goodbye to Anthony Rendon.
Yeah, I'd say that this does 3 things for the Nationals. One, they get to keep a great pitcher along with Max Scherzer. He'll keep the Nationals in the conversation, the National League East, in 2020. I do think that signing Strasburg gives them a get-out-of-jail-free card when it comes to the Anthony Rendon negotiations, that the fan base, even if they don't sign Rendon, and I agree with you, I think now it's just about a certainty he's going to wind up someplace else, it allows them to pivot. And I think part of the cost here is for legacy, right? I mean, this pretty much locks down Strasburg you know, to finish his career with the Nationals, but also to be the guy who's going to come back and throw out first pitches and sit behind home plate occasionally like Nolan Ryan. I think that's part of how they get to 245. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, and that's part of the math that I just don't do myself, but organizations think emotionally, or at least some of them do. The Nationals, yep, in this case, coming off of a World Series championship, have the luxury of doing that. The way that most executives think now, is quite the opposite. But it's hard to blame the Nationals for doing this, especially considering the postseason that he just had. I'm of the opinion, personally, that if you have $245 million to spend, spending it on an everyday player is a wiser investment, especially one without the kind of injury history that Steven Strasburg has. But you can connect the dots pretty easily and see why they'd ultimately landed on the long-term deal for Strasburg instead of Rendon.
All right, we have to give absolute kudos to Scott Boras for the way that he played this. He gets Strasburg done, and that absolutely tees up Garrett Cole for his negotiation. I don't think it's a coincidence that the final number is 245. You heard the other day, or you saw the other day, the New York Times, it leaked out in a report that after that was, you know, knocked down by sources, that the Yankees were preparing to offer Garrett Cole $245 million. Well, you know what? That's incredibly outdated. And I do think now, if we see the contract for Garrett Cole coming up, starting with the number three, nine-figure contract, starting with the number three, that would not be a surprise.
Me neither. For 8 or even 9 years, potentially, Buster, statistically, Garrett Cole has been about 35% better than Steven Strasburg over the last two seasons, both in terms of his run prevention and in terms of his total value by wins above replacement. He's also 2 years younger. $35 million was sort of like the ceiling of what I thought he could get annually, which is just what Steven Strasburg got. And like I said, he's 2 years younger with a more durable body and a cleaner injury history. So it's not a coincidence that the number was 245. I agree with that. It's also not a coincidence that Strasburg got done first. And I wouldn't say the Nationals were bidding against themselves by any stretch, but usually you see deals like this happen, monster deals like this happen when players change teams because teams are willing to, you know, pay 120, 130 cents on the dollar. So like you said, $300 million is very much within the realm of possibility, and the all-time record for average annual value, which is 35 and change by Mike Trout, I think is also very much on the table to be broken.
Where do you think that the bidding goes now for Anthony Rendon? Look, we talked about the Dodgers maybe being a team interested in a shorter-term deal. I've had executives of other teams who really believe that the Texas Rangers are perfectly positioned to pay a big fee to get him. What's your sense of where that's going to wind up?
I maintain the opinion that the Rangers are the likeliest team to sign him, but I also maintain the opinion that the White Sox are the team that should sign him. The White Sox have swung and missed on free agents, it seems, aplenty over the last 2 years, and they're seemingly dying to spend their money. And Anthony Rendon would immediately make that team at least a fringe contender for the wild card, in my judgment. But I think he ends up landing with the Rangers, given the new ballpark, and that'll obviously make Troy Farkas very happy.
No kidding. All right, a couple of other issues before you go. I want to see if you agree with this. I thought about this after Marvin Miller gained induction to the Hall of Fame, or gained election to the Hall of Fame the other day. He'll be inducted next summer, posthumously. You know what? I absolutely think this potentially sets a precedent where Agent Scott Boras at some point makes a speech in Cooperstown. And let me give you my rationale behind it before you jump all over me and say, you are insane, okay? As we talked about with Tim yesterday, Marvin Miller was not like a baseball guy. It wasn't like he was working to make Major League Baseball better. He was a union lawyer who did a great job at representing the interest of his clients. And through his work, he became a significant figure in baseball, and he advanced baseball as well. Scott Boras is without question someone who has been a significant figure in baseball while representing the interest of his clients, much in the way Marvin Miller did. I'm not making the argument that he's as important as Marvin Miller, but I think there will be a day when people talk about historical figures in baseball history. Scott Boras will be one of those. Are you buying or are you saying, get out of here with that crap?
You make a compelling case. I will say a couple things as it relates to Boras. Much like Marvin Miller, I think one of the reasons it took Miller so long is because he just wasn't like that well liked by so many people that really matter, right? So that's a big part of this. And Buster, this might sound like hyperbole, but I don't think it is. If you're creating a Mount Rushmore in baseball history, I think there are three people that have to be on it. I think Jackie Robinson, who's breaking the color barrier, was the most significant thing that happened on American soil in the last century, in my opinion. Babe Ruth, who for all intents and purposes popularized the home run and did more for baseball than any singular athlete has ever done for his or her sport. and Marvin Miller, because the elimination of the reserve clause, Buster, was as foundational to the fabric of baseball for its first 100 years as practically anything. And for Marvin Miller to do what he accomplished through the union, baseball ownership has benefited from it a great deal, even though obviously at the time they didn't know that. And obviously players have as well. I mean, baseball's attendance doubled in the 20 years after the reserve clause went down. And we saw a $100 million contract for a Major League Baseball player in 1999. And so much of Marvin Miller's impact, the trickle down effect of his work is still seen in Major League Baseball today. He was so far ahead of his time. And for Bowie Kuhn to be in the Hall of Fame for 10, 12 years before Marvin Miller was, when he just undressed him so many times in litigation, is sort of a joke. But you know what? Better late than never.
And I know you wanted to talk about Zach Wheeler going to your beloved Philadelphia Phillies.
Well, this is a little bit old news, but I do think there are some numbers that are worth mentioning as they relate to Wheeler. And I'm of the opinion that his numbers will improve going to Philly, even if he doesn't, Buster. I shared these with you last week. Last season, he ranked 49th among 61 qualified pitchers in strike-looking rate. In other words, his catchers didn't do him any favors as it relates to framing. He ranked 57th among 61 qualified pitchers in out rate on batted balls, which we can attribute to bad defense, which we know the Mets have. So Wheeler's numbers should improve, even if he doesn't, just by virtue of better surroundings. And I'll also say this, as it relates to Zach Wheeler. It seems to me that there are a lot more executives interested in him as opposed to Cole and Strasburg, just because of the price. And with how favorably the StatCast metrics view him, and with how good that his four-seam fastball is and how little he used it, you can at least dream on the profile. You can at least dream on the profile. So while he's never had a great season, it's pretty clear to me that the Phillies and other clubs convince themselves that he can have some great seasons with them if they just modify his pitch mix and improve the players around him, for lack of a better term.
I totally agree with everything you just said, but you never gave an opinion of whether or not you agree with me that Scott Boras, at some point, could be a candidate for Hall of Fame election. Are you buying or no?
I did dodge your question as you shrewdly observed. I will say that I agree with you that Scott Boras' impact on baseball is worthy of consideration, and it's hard to argue otherwise, but it's very difficult for me to see a person that does what he does get elected to the Hall of Fame. I don't think fans care that much, which is why I think the Marvin Miller thing was such a big deal, because he's such a big part of the story, but I can't imagine a world in which Scott Boras is making a Hall of Fame speech. But what do I know? But in 20 or 30 years from now, you never know what that thing might look like or the conversation that there might be. But I'll tell you what, it's a really compelling case, and I'm looking forward to reading your column on it.
Yeah, he's been a polarizing figure, just like Marvin Miller has been in baseball. I haven't had a warm relationship with him through the years, but again, it's a museum that notes baseball history, and he has clearly been an important part of baseball history. I think that's inarguable. All right, Hambo, thanks for doing this.
Later, boys.
Clint Yates is a columnist for The Undefeated, like me. He was born in Washington, D.C., and he's a host of ESPN's YouTube show from the winter meetings in San Diego this week. And Clinton, just explain what you're doing out there on YouTube.
Well, you know, what we're doing is Jeff Passan, those of you who know the MLB Insider, we're basically just sitting down for about a half hour every single day and going over what is going on at the winter meetings. Obviously, listeners to your show understand what happens at these, but for everybody, they don't necessarily know. There's a lot of ins, there's a lot of outs, there's a lot of people you meet, there's a lot of things that may or may not happen, and keeping abreast of what's happening from a day-to-day standpoint is what we're catching everybody up on as an audience.
All right, so give me your visceral reaction to the news yesterday that Steven Strasburg has agreed to terms to go back to the Nationals. I said earlier in the show, I thought all along that he was going to go back, because Steven is not someone who likes change. What do you think?
I agree with that part, but there were so many different machinations that mattered there, Buster, that made me wonder what was happening once it finally did happen. However, my initial reaction was simply gasp. $245 million just as a number was very shocking to me. And it wasn't just about the number, the amount of years, or, you know, the fact that him staying, it was about how they were going to do that, because the Nationals, as we know, well, they have a bit of a reputation in terms of how they do business. We remember what happened with Bryce in terms of all of the deferred money, and Harper decided he wanted to leave, and everybody said, okay, we'll just kind of eat that. And then we thought about what was going to happen with Tony Rendon in terms of what they offered him during the season versus what was going to happen at the end of the season. So when it came to Strasburg, people were kind of thinking, man, this is going to be a really tough one. And then they won the World Series. And so after that, everything sort of felt like, okay, he's probably going to stay for the reasons you described, but I was shocked at the amount of money because I think it was a lot. Gerrit Cole hadn't signed yet, and everything just felt like, man, they are really paying a high premium for a guy who was a World Series MVP.
Now, you referenced the offers to Bryce Harper and Anthony Rendon. I think when we look at it from 30,000 feet, we can say that those were kind of like public relations ploys. The timing of those offers, the timing of those offers, you know, at the end of the regular season, that to me was the Nationals basically setting themselves up to say, see, we tried. And then I feel like with the Strasburg contract, that's like a legacy tax. What do you think?
I totally agree. And somebody asked me the other day, what do you think about this? I said, well, $80 million deferred plus interest is apparently the price of a World Series ring if you're the Learners. And that's fine. However, when I talked to Mike Rizzo yesterday, I asked him, I said, you do understand that losing a player like Tony Rendon from this team is going to affect not just the fan base, but the baseball in a way that you can't really replace considering the availability of a bunch of other players. And his reply, you know, fairly enough in this context of business was, we're committed to winning it all. Basically saying, we know it's going to suck, and that's just what we're going to have to deal with. And so, yes, I do think that there was an element of PR to what they chose to talk about publicly with Tony Rendon. However, with Strasburg, I mean, it's not unfortunate in the context of, I don't think that they should have kept him, or rather, should not have kept him in order to keep Tony Rendon, but you would have liked to see a situation in which the team could have publicly pursued both, but they're just not there because the Learners don't want to commit that kind of money. They don't want to talk about the luxury tax. And there's a whole host of other reasons. You can look right at the manager of the team as to why they don't spend money in certain places that other big league teams do. And so it's unfortunate in that context because you don't get to keep everybody that you know you needed considering how they got to the playoffs, but it makes sense from a business standpoint if you accept their operating principle is fair.
It would make absolute sense to me if they were to be the team to call the Cubs and say, look, we'll give you a couple of prospects and we'll take Chris Bryant off your hands for at least the next year, maybe two, depending on this decision that comes down and his grievance against the Cubs over service time. What do you think?
I think that's an excellent idea. I love that. I don't think Chris Bryant is as good as Tony Rendon for this team. That's a personal opinion. It doesn't mean I think Chris Bryant is bad. But that is a stopgap that I think would make sense because, number one, look, I mean, if Brent wants to get out of Chicago, as you stated, then yes, you love to pick up a guy who's ready to go. The weird part, though, is that Tony is kind of that guy, too. He doesn't apparently want to be in D.C., which is an awkward little, I don't want to say secret, but a thing that people talk about. And I love Brian. I think that, I like his game. I'm still thinking about how a player like Anthony Rendon leaving affects the long-term free agent situation with Washington and the fans, because look, you drafted, developed, and watched Tony Rendon blossom. If you win the World Series with a guy like that and he doesn't even want to stay, what does that say about your franchise? It's kind of a bummer when you think about it that way.
I would agree with you on that. I do think that because they won the World Series, that ownership and the front office get out of jail free card, I think extends for a couple years. We saw that with the San Francisco Giants as they made moves earlier in this decade.
Yep.
It feels like from afar, like you guys are waiting for the puffs of smoke to rise over the winter meetings is to learn about Gerrit Cole. What do you think?
That's exactly what's going on. Yesterday, before Jeff and I went on air, he literally looked at me and said, we got Stras news. And we had been planning on talking about Gerrit Cole for the entire program until that happened. So, yeah, he's a big get for a lot of different reasons. Obviously, his stuff is electric. Obviously, he's a younger guy than Strasburg. Obviously, that number, 245, sort of changes everything in terms of his availability, you know, and what he's going to sign for. And he wants to go. We saw what happened after he wasn't thrown in Game 7. So you got a motivated pitcher who's got the best stuff, you know, probably in the bigs, according to some people, and he's actually free. I don't know how big this number is going to be, Buster, but a lot of people are talking about $300 million, and I just can't even think about that in terms of, you know, what the overall sum of that is. But we'll see. I just hope that for wherever he goes, and I say this for the sake of baseball, he doesn't get into a situation like he got into the end of last season. I like that guy. I think he's a gamer. I think he's a competitor, and he can really throw. I want to see him be on a team where he really likes being there as well.
And as soon as he signs, I think a lot of the focus in the free agent market is going to turn to Madison Bumgarner, at least among the media. And as it plays out, and then yesterday there were reports that his representation has met with the San Francisco Giants. You know what? That makes sense. We just talked about a legacy tax with the Nationals and Steven Strasburg because he's that guy. I feel like in the end, Baumgartner's worth more to the Giants than any other team because of what he's accomplished with that club. Does that make sense to you?
Baumgartner is not only worth more to the Giants than any other team. I think that Baumgartner is worth more to the big leagues as a Giant than he is on any other team in any other place. And that's important, I think, for that team, and probably at the end will end up being important for him because, look, I'm not gonna pass judgment on what Madison Bumgarner's gonna do, but that guy, you know, he's kind of a hard ass. You know what I mean? That dude walks into a clubhouse and you're dealing with Madison Bumgarner, and that's what you get on the mound, that's what you get in the clubhouse, that's what you get in the dugout, and I don't know how well that necessarily is going to play anywhere else, even though it is an effective method of being a ball player. I think if he leaves the Giants, that would be a real, I don't know, it would be a real disappointment in my opinion in terms of a player and a team not getting something done. And overall, I just don't know how well that guy walks into another city and says, hi, I'm Madison Bumgarner, take me as I am, and have it all work out. I think San Fran is the place he's got to be in order for that to continue.
What time is your show on again for folks who want to find it?
Noon Pacific. That would be 3 p.m. Eastern. And it is myself and Jeff Passan, Baseball Tonight, at the winter meetings. You can see us standing live. And if John Guccione comes by, he might photobomb us again live on the air.
And last one, I'm trying to remember our conversation from the spring. Were you also, like me, born in Columbia Hospital for Women?
I was not. I was born in George Washington University Hospital, and I was born there the week before our president, Ronald Reagan, got shot. And that is the historical reminder that I tell people. If you want to know when I was born, look up the Hinckley Hotel on Connecticut Avenue in D.C. It was right there.
There you go. Clinton, have fun. Thanks for doing this.
Boss, appreciate it, man.
Derek Gold covers the St. Louis Cardinals for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And, Derek, the Cardinals won the National League Central, strong finish to their season. So as they look ahead to 2020, as I look ahead for them, I don't think it's an easy path necessarily to upgrade this team. What do you see them trying to do this winter?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. There's not like, I mean, you could like probably cherry pick a few places like for them to add depth. But you're right. I mean, it's more like a team in need of some fine tuning to improve upon what they did last year, starting with the offense. I mean, they had the worst offense of the 10 playoff teams. They were the only playoff team of the 10 who did not have a slugging percentage in the top 5 in the majors, did not have an OPS. I'm sorry, in the top 15 in the majors, did not have an OPS in the top 15 in the majors. And part of that was because so many, as John Mozeliak told me just the other day, he's like, look up and down the lineup. Not like we had a lot of guys overachieve. Some guys just didn't even hit to their career. That starts with Matt Carpenter, who really struggled all year. The Cardinals want to add a left-handed bat if possible. That would mean kind of packaging some young outfielders who hit right-handed for that left-handed bat. But they also want to bring back their most prominent left-handed bat to health, to strength, to production, and that's Matt Carpenter. They also played a really strong run prevention game this past year, and that's something that's really worked at Busch Stadium. The last two teams that have excelled at run prevention have won 100 games in 2015 and then won the division this past year. So they're looking at the depth of pitching in this marketplace and going, well, you could get stronger at something that they already did well. But it's not like they're rushing out to do these things. They don't really have like a shopping list that they have to check through, like middle order hitter the last few years or shortstop 4 or 5 years ago. They're more like, let's see where things go, where conversations take us, and just be aware of the improvement that is possible, but that it might happen, you know, late December. It might happen January. It might be July that they make that move, and they got to be comfortable with that.
Who are some guys potentially, as you sort of scan the market and speculate a little bit, who are some potential players you see who could fit the profile of what you're talking about?
I mean, they're going to use left-handed to break all ties. So Madison Bumgarner, Dallas Keuchel, we'll see where Bumgarner's contract goes. His asking price, obviously, is pretty high now. We'll see where that heads. Dallas Keuchel has interested them before. There was some concern from them about, you know, durability and what he was going to be like last year. He answered some of the Cardinals' questions with how he pitched with the Braves. there is at least, you know, I talked to Dallas Keuchel during the season. He said he expected an offer from the Cardinals last year and that he would welcome the chance to talk to them again this year as a free agent. So, you know, they want to find some kind of left-handed look for that rotation, and they're going to side with innings. That's the one thing that they're kind of prioritizing because they have Carlos Martinez maybe in the rotation, maybe not. They won't really know his ability to handle that workload until spring training, so they won't have some innings available there. I think, you know, boy, for the trademark, you know, for the left-handed hitting outfielder, they really are veering towards trade, and you know they're trying to engage in teams. I mean, is Texas a match? Well, they don't match up necessarily salary wise and control years wise, but they certainly line up left-handed and right-handed. That's a conversation the Cardinals have. You know, do they talk to the Orioles? You know, do they reengage year after year with Colorado? That seems to not be have much movement either, but that's the kind of talks that they're trying to have, is go to teams that have a handful of left-handed batters, might be looking for a right-handed hitting outfielder, and can they find a way to make it all line up that it's mutually beneficial. It's not been swift moving at all in that regard.
Total speculation on my part. I'm just throwing out a name to you that I, as you were talking, was like, man, Cole Calhoun potentially could be a fit on a short-term cheap deal to sort of to build in that extra depth and the, you know, potential platoon matchups for Mike Schilt.
Yeah, so it's interesting because it's definitely on their mind, but Mozeliak yesterday, because we were kind of dancing around, you know how the dance goes, right?
Yeah.
They don't want to talk about specific names. They don't want to, so you talk generalities, right? But one of the things he did say is that the preference is not to take from what they have and then create a platoon situation. They would like to take from what they have to get an answer. You know, so like Jock Peterson, right? If they were to make a move for Jock Peterson, they have to be aware that, 109 of his plate appearances the past 2 years are against left-handed batters. The Dodgers have maximized him by not having him play all that often against left-handed batters. Mozeliak said that the platoon notion is not one that is appealing to them, and it's one of the reasons why their first thought right now is to find out in trade. Now, if they have to go to that route for a platoon, then that's fine. They want some kind of balance to their lineup. This part is really interesting, I think, and it kind of struck me as we were talking, is he's like, it just would offer a different look to the lineup. And, you know, one of the things we saw over and over and over again last year, and you certainly saw in the National League Championship Series from Washington, is if you had an approach against the Cardinals, it worked against all the Cardinals. You just saw Goldschmidt behind in the count a lot, Ozuna behind in the count a lot, Young behind in the count a lot. These were all right-handed hitters who, you know, the pitchers could set up a plan and then stick to it. And I asked Mozeliak about that last night, if he thinks just throwing a different look in there, a vintage Matt Carpenter, a left-handed alternative that they add from the outside. He said, well, it would definitely be something different that they'd have to plan for. It would be more complex, and it would be less of the same thing that they just saw handcuff him constantly.
All right, two more quick ones for you. I wrote about this the other day. I really feel like that Harold Baines' election last year, and I covered Harold. He's a great guy. I'm happy for him that he got to make the speech at Cooperstown. I really feel like it sort of clouds some of the standards for voters to consider. Now, I don't vote anymore. You vote. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that way as we move forward, where you're sort of looking to define exactly who would qualify for the Hall of Fame for you, or does it not have any effect on it whatsoever?
I think it doesn't have any effect on it whatsoever. I've thought a lot about that. You know, the standards that the Veterans Committee used are 12 people, you know, in a room. Those 12 people rotate. I can agree with their decisions. I cannot. But I do like the way that James Ward Clark described it, that committee is there just to find ways or to find players that slip through the cracks. I think Baines, I think we all know he got strong advocacy from Tony La Russa in the room. We personally, a group of us in St. Louis, always waited for Ted Simmons to get the same kind of advocacy in that room because he slipped through the cracks of the baseball writers' vote. My view of this is as a guy who votes for the Hall of Fame, I think of it as a tremendous responsibility. I've described it as an article. I have to put in the same research. I have to put in the same, care, have to same in, put in the same integrity to my ballot that I would a story with my byline on it. My signature on that ballot is a story, is my byline. So I think of it as like, look, that committee is there to catch things on their opinion. It's not going to shift how I look at the rating that I use or the research that I do, because I'm voting on whether the people on that ballot are Hall of Famers. If they qualify, in my opinion, after my research, I'm not comparing them against Harold Baines.
And I explained to Paul Imbecides why I would not be surprised, and I'm not saying anytime soon, I'm saying in 20, 25 mm-hmm. years, it's possible that Scott Boras might be someone who would be considered for the Hall of Fame. I think his impact on the sport has been undeniable. Are you buying or do you think it's ridiculous?
I don't think it's ridiculous at all. I mean, what are the magnetic poles of modern baseball? Analytics and Boras, right? Is that where we're at?
Yeah.
Analytics are driving, defining not only how the game is evaluated, but also how the game is played now. And Scott Boras has been a driving force, whether agents like him or not, general managers like him or not, in the rising cost of players, in the rising salaries, in elite talent getting paid substantial, significant, otherworldly dollars. I also, to be candid and to be brief, I think some of the things that he said here recently are, especially at the GM meetings, about the marketplace and about the concerns he has for how the game has been gripped by analytics. I know he has a bit of a bone to pick there, but I think it's important that somebody says that. I think sometimes he steps up on his soapbox and says what others are thinking, and often with a metaphor, often with some flowery language. But I think that's important to have that voice as opposed to only have it whispered as an anonymous source or some agent says. And I think Boras has given that voice to a side of the game that really, he's given a megaphone to that side of the game that is necessary. So I don't think it's all that outlandish. No, I mean, he's a big part of the modern game.
All right, Derek. Well, thanks for making time for us, and I appreciate all of the great work that you do.
Happy to do so. Thanks, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster. First round of Bleacher Tweets here. The first one today comes from our guy, P.K. Steinberg. At P.K. Steinberg.
P.K.!
Steven Strasburg staying with the Nationals is great for baseball. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely. But more importantly, I'm really happy for Steven. We've talked about how this is someone who doesn't like change. He appreciated what he had in Washington. You heard it in his voice there. D.C. is like home. I'm glad for him that he's staying in Washington.
I'm certainly happy for him. Today in sports, especially in basketball, there's so much free agency, yep, and people are always going places. No one spends their career with one team anymore, so I'm really happy for him. Strasburg's a great guy, so from what I see. Montgomery Bopp at MJBopp24. Which is the greater factor in the early offseason action? Players accepting the market conditions or teams being ready to spend after years of adjusting and settling into their analytical strategies?
I think it's B. I think teams are being more aggressive, feeling like, you know what, we have to win. And I'm guessing, too, they probably know that on the horizon there's going to be some anti-tanking type measures that are going to be taking. And so that strategy, I think, is about ready to become obsolete, and teams are going to be more aggressive. And they do have money.
Here's Brandon Paul Reusler at Win
Wrestler,
for
yep.
Wrestler, okay. Win for Gwynn. It's no secret you aren't a fan of the moves AJ Preller has made, Buster, but can you give Padres fans three things to be optimistic about with this team?
Yeah, and for the record, when I've criticized the Padres for what they're doing, I haven't been wrong yet. Like in 2014, the winter, when they ramped it up, I was writing, I thought it was a bad idea because it knew the market. And guess what? It didn't go well. And then when they cut all the way back and went with teenagers and prospects, I was like, boy, it's a long process to go through. I was critical of the Hosmer deal, which doesn't look good right now. And I've been critical this winter of them sort of trying to jumpstart the process and move it along a little faster. And I still think it's a mistake. So the three things that are going well, obviously, they built a tremendous farm system. You love Fernando Tatis Jr. You love Chris Paddock. You like some of the youngsters coming up. And as I said on the podcast yesterday, I've heard from executives, they like that the Padres are improving the balance in their everyday lineup. That's more than three reasons, but there are reasons to be excited about what the Padres are doing.
There you go, Brandon. positivity, Buster. I appreciate it. Eric E. at Esoteric Eric Zero. Hey, Buster and Troy, who do you think are some of the best under-the-radar free agent names who will be overshadowed by big names but will prove to be big impact additions this offseason?
Man, I love the Braves signing of Cole Hamels, 1 year and $18 million, because it's pretty clear that before he suffered that oblique injury in late June, he was having a good season, had an ERA under 3, and so now you get Cole Hamels at the front of that rotation. That, to me, was a really nice move. We talked yesterday about some of your Rangers moves, Troy. I like them, and I haven't gotten your full opinion on how you, you know, how you view this rotation they're building in a competitive American League West.
Yeah, I mean, no big names coming to the Rangers rotation, but a lot of savvy veterans, and Hembo was giving us the numbers yesterday that outside of Lynn and Minor, or maybe it was Sarah, outside of Lynn and Minor, their rotation last year was in like the sevens ERA. So by the people that we've signed this year, the rotation that we're building, we're trying to get away from that as much as possible. So I'm liking it. Hopefully we can land Rendon and be competitive in the AL West, and that hopefully Garrett Cole doesn't sign with the Angels.
And one more thing about that. Kyle Gibson is one of the starters they signed. I talked to an executive with another team who, you know, just kind of pointed me to some before and after pictures of Gibson. When if you look at him in pictures in the spring and then the end of the year, it was pretty clear he lost about 20 pounds because he battled colitis the whole year. So the fact that he was as effective as he was is a credit to him. The fact he stayed on the mound is a credit to him. I checked with the Rangers. They're very, of course, on top of this, and they absolutely believe that this is, you know, this is someone who can be even better than he was last year as he comes back from the E. coli that he suffered last winter.
I'll have to exchange notes with our friend Rena Bonina about Kyle Gibson to see what I should know about him. Thanks for the tweets this morning. Keep them coming all throughout the winter meetings this week. Use hashtag Bleacher Tweets.
That's it for today. My thanks to Derek, to Clinton, to Hembo, to Troy. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we'll have another podcast for you on Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.